From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 35th installment of our ongoing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the USSR, and we're going to be speaking today about actually a Western phenomenon, anti-Soviet propaganda, and it's relevant even today, isn't it?
Yes, it is, isn't it, Don? Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'd say it's the most relevant thing that's happened in a long time. All you have to do is flip through the news channels, and it's been Russia, 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 Russia all over the place.
Yes.
Evil baby killers. That's what they are today.
Yeah, I hadn't planned to say this, but I'm going to say it. I think it was Lloyd George who said that Russia, Bolshevik or otherwise, was a threat to the British Empire.
Of course, yep.
And now it is a threat to the American Empire. It's progress.
Right. Yeah, I mean, well, so, you know, the Soviet Union was certainly a threat to the British Empire in that, among other things, ideologically, it was anti-imperialist. And
exactly.
That's the sin.
Absolutely, exactly,
yep.
That. And yep. I think it was mentioned. They knew very well that, ideologically, yes. And also, they provided, the Soviet Union provided support and training and weapons, etc., to the colonies.
Yep. National liberation struggle. So, yeah. Okay. Well, so let's look at some of the, what would the word be? Some of the archetypes, for example, that have been established, to use the term that's a favorite of a friend of mine. The legend of Stalin.
Archetypal myths.
Yes, exactly. Like Stalin as Dracula. The communist Dracula. Blah, blah.
Perfect. It's a Slav from the East.
That's right.
Okay, so today the topic is anti-Soviet propaganda and how to be objective about it.
Right.
It ties in with what we were talking about in former programs, in the last few programs, which was about Trotsky, who became an anti-Soviet propagandist. In the end.
Yeah, the anti-Soviet propagandist in many ways, because he was the one that was pitching to the left and fractured the left.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the left that's damaging. Trotsky, Khrushchev, Gorbachev, Yeltsin doesn't count.
He's not left.
But, you know, those are the people that are the most dangerous.
Yeah, Yeltsin was left at last call. That's all. That's all his left was, yeah.
Oh, okay, let's go. So, anti-Soviet propaganda. So, preamble. I think this is an important topic because we, the people in the West, are educated. In fact, we are conditioned to loathe the Soviet Union. And just about everybody hates it in the West.
It's an evil empire.
Trotsky. I beg your pardon?
The evil empire.
Yeah. The Trotskys hate it because Stalin, not Trotsky, built the Soviet Union. The Social Democrats hate it because it was revolutionary and rejected capitalism. The capitalists hate it, obviously, because it is the antagonist. The mass media hates it, and it is owned by the capitalist. The schools, the colleges, and the universities, the publisher, and the whole hegemonic apparatus hates it. The ideological orientation of Western education is, of course, not to turn out communists or socialists. So the curriculum and the research are directed towards sustaining and replicating the status quo. So that's a reality we have to face, those of us that are outside this massive Western anti-Soviet sentiment. I don't think I'm exaggerating.
No.
So we in the West have a hard time being objective about the Soviet Union. So let's see what objectivity entails. So how do we, what is objectivity? Actually, it's a scientific method of distrusting the self. It is a process of becoming aware of, to identify, and then to doubt one's own preconceived ideas. One must be automatically suspicious of evidence that tends to confirm one's own preconceived ideas. This is very difficult to do. I notice it in myself every day. Everything that confirms my own predisposition, I immediately latch onto. And then I have to stop myself and say, who says this? What is the source? What is the interest? And I have to actually stop myself and examine everything. It's a very difficult thing to do. And it needs training, and it's like learning a foreign language. So, so when we read, let's say 1969, the publication of Robert Conquest, The Great Terror, where he, the most important page in the book is where he says that Stalin killed 20 to 30 million people. That at a certain point, 60 million working age Russians were in the camps. 60 million working age, 25 million working age, I got the thing mixed up. 25 million working age people were in the camps out of 60 million working people. I mean, these things, I wasn't going to talk about Conquest now. It's just identifying the myths. But when we read that book, 1969, Robert Conquest, The Great Terror, or 2010, Timothy Snyder, Bloodlands, you know, we know that those are lies, but others should not use these books as confirmation of their preconceived ideas. Otherwise, the myths go on. Right. So, 8 myths. The collectivization of agriculture to examine. 8 myths to examine for what they say and what the reality is. So, number one, collectivization of agriculture. The famine of 1932-33, which is the so-called Holodomor. Number three, the Great Terror, or Yezoshvina. Number four, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. Number five, the alleged invasion of Poland in September 1939. Number six, the Katyn massacre. Number seven, the Warsaw Uprising. And number eight, Stalin's anti-Semitism. These are the major myths that are then recycled in Timothy Snyder's Bloodlands, which is a very, a very influential work of anti-Sovietism, which has been translated in 20 languages. I mean, he's an official regime intellectual. So that's why did we need a book in 2010 that picks up all these myths again, when actually the Soviet Union was dissolved? Because for some reason this because it serves the cause of anti-socialism, but also what Timothy Snyder's Bloodlands did was to equate Hitler and Stalin, and to simply nullify any possibility of the renewal of socialism. So let's look at collectivization of agriculture, and together with the famine of 1932-33 in Ukraine, the so-called Holodomor. Now, what happened in the famine of 1932-33, two explanations are offered. The Ukrainian nationalists say, well, the Stalin government withheld grain from Ukrainian peasants in order to export it, and deliberately starved Ukrainian peasants because they were striving for independence. Now, the Holodomor myth, which is patterned after the Holocaust, it originated in the Ukrainian diaspora. That would be Canada and the United States. And actually, as far as I can tell, that term emerged in the 1980s during the Reagan's a new assault against the Soviet Union as the evil empire. So the Holodomor is a recent invention, that name. And originated in Harvard and, or landed in Harvard and was elaborated. Now, the diaspora were Ukrainians who had fought alongside the Nazis in Galicia and fled to the West with the Nazi armies, the German armies in retreat when the Red Army invaded the when the Red Army reconquered the places that had been occupied. The second explanation for the famines that support the myth of the evil Soviet government, the second one, it is argued that due to collectivization and excessive state grain requisition, which led to mismanagement and peasant rebellion and to famine and starvation. So that collectivization led to famine and starvation because of mismanagement and appropriation of excessive grain. And this, unfortunately, is the position of the Russian government today. Now, neither of these two really are borne by primary evidence that scholars have been unearthing since the opening of the Russian archives. In fact, there was a decline in exports, but it is estimated that by scholars who are studying that even a complete cessation of export would not have prevented the famine, because the harvest of 1932 made famine inevitable. So the reality is that collectivization put an end to famine in the Soviet Union, except for a famine in 1946-47, which was due to environmental causes and, of course, the disruption of the war. So what really happened? What is the counter-explanation? Well, during the famine of 1928-29 is the beginning of the first five-year plan of Stalin's five-year plan. So there was a famine in 1928-29, and this convinced the leaders that Soviet agriculture had to be changed. They attributed the historic and endemic famines of the Soviet Union to agricultural backwardness. The collectivization of agriculture was designed to end the cycle of famines. It was a reform. It was a significant improvement in the security of the lives of the peasantry, 81%, 80 over of the whole population, but also of the whole population. So from 1929-1939, the Soviet government spent billions on agriculture to increase food production using modern and reliable methods, mechanization, and patterning their methods by studying U.S. agriculture in the West, and had experts come and from America to instruct them.
Yep. And you know what's interesting about them coming from America, by the way, they were leaving. They were leaving the dirty 30s, you know, the Dust Bowl. You had, you know, huge chunks of agricultural sections of the United States were under the condition of drought. The topsoil had been deeply plowed and damaged. The agricultural sector was devastated in the United States. You had millions of people driven off their farms. Because they couldn't pay their mortgages or grow crops because of the Dust Bowl. They would have black blizzards, as they call them, all the way into New York City and Washington from soil that was airborne from the Midwest. These are the same people that wanted to lecture others.
Say that again, lizards?
Black blizzards or black rollers. Ooh. Here in the United States, there were choking billows of dust that traveled as far as the East Coast, Washington and New York, among others, reducing visibility in the plains to 3 feet or less. And this was the soil and the dirt just being airborne because it was cut loose because of the farming practices prior and the drought.
Yes. And but didn't Roosevelt put together studies in agriculture?
When
did it turn?
Well, Roosevelt, during the first 100 days in 1933, jumped on the soil conservation and some other things. Because you had, I guess you had three waves, I think, of when this happened, and it began in the late 20s and early 30s, and it continued until like 1940, because the problem was so well established. You know, the conditions were so pervasive that it took a decade of attack. But some places were suffering this drought and these Dust Bowl conditions for 8, 9, 10 years.
Good heavens.
Yeah, the waves were 1934 was one wave, 1936 another, and then 1939 and 40. But really from the late 20s until 1940.
Yeah, it's interesting because I used to teach the Grapes of Wrath.
Exactly.
Which documents that horrible disaster.
That was a contemporaneous report. Steinbeck wrote that in 1939, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was like, he's reporting, basically, you know, through that device.
Yeah, that's right.
Sorry, go ahead.
Very kind of perfunctorily over these three, and I think we can expand later on.
Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
In more details. And the third myth is. The myth of the, or what has been known as the Great Terror, which is difficult to explain in short terms, but okay, I will try. The Great Terror, or the Yezovshina. Yezov was the head of the NKVD by 1937. Now, supposedly this is the time that has come down to us as Stalin directed mass murder of 30 million people.
Right.
But he killed 30 million, and it's now gotten to be even 100 million, people. There have been claims of that sort of outrageous number.
Which would depopulate the Soviet Union, which at the time had a population of between 150 and 200 million people. So killing 100 million, you'd probably notice.
Yes, you would notice, and then who would fight the war?
Right, exactly.
You know, I mean, so those numbers are just incredible. Let me reach for my notes, if I can. Well, let me first explain, just give a framework. Mm-hmm. Now, Yezhov became the head of the NKVD, and what happened, the Great Terror supposedly started in 1937, a month after the trial of Tukhachevsky, of general of the military trial of Tukhachevsky, which found top army personnel had been involved in conspiracies with the Germans to overthrow the Soviet government. And Tukhachevsky and top army personnel were found guilty of treason and executed. So there was a, from the point of view of the Politburo, the army was not the most dependable at that point of institution. So the NKVD was the only one that they could rely on. Nevertheless, excuse me, Yezhov passed on to Stalin a telegram coming from Western Siberia, from one of the secretaries there, saying that there was insurrection and conspiracy with the Japanese, and asking for what are those called, special powers to put these insurrections and these conspiracies down.
Right.
And in fact, the Politburo did issue permission to kill the worst and put down the rest. Hmm. Now, what happened was that for the whole year of 1937, Stalin was receiving countless numbers of reports of insurrections in the outer lands. And mass murders of innocent people did occur. But what really happened was that Yezhov himself was found guilty and confessed that the object of the mass murders was to actually raise rebellions against the Soviet government. In other words, P was part of the conspiracy and was spinning out conspiracy and killing innocent people.
Right.
So I don't know how we can look at this. But all I'm asking here is that we look at these myths and become agnostic and look into it. The legend is that Stalin himself was the monster that out of his own desk, was just killing willy-nilly everybody that he could. Whereas the situation that we look at in the 30s was a very difficult and tense situation and complicated. And at any rate, we cannot assign to Stalin alone the deaths, the so-called, well, the mass murder of some innocent people, we should consider that this period might be considered a second civil war. That, I mean, I'm not going to talk about the Moscow trials here, you know, because I'm afraid that we're going to run out of time.
Right.
But what about if we just simply considered that there was a state of siege within the Soviet Union, that since 1934, with the murder of Kirov, things were coming out. The army was conspiring. And this is all put down to Stalin paranoia, to his personality. In the West, it is ascribed to the fact that he was paranoid, that none of this was happening, that he just willy-nilly started this Jacobin, you know, mass murder. Now, I don't know, let's see if I can find Great Terror, 1969, just one second.
Yeah, well, why you do that? Because it's interesting for people to note that Churchill, for example, is talking about smothering the great baboonery that was Bolshevism in its cradle in 1919. This is before Stalin and Stalinism were even identified as some kind of a threat, and even the question of bureaucratism or whatever. This was a raw reaction of imperialism, a fundamental one, to the threat of an alternate system that would not allow them to sit at the pinnacle of the state and economy, but rather would democratize them. And that is the real offense committed by the Soviet state that produced all of the things that followed from the West, including the responses that we see today.
Yeah, that's right. No, it's what I was looking for was the total, but it's difficult because the total of what the West assesses had perished in the what they call the Great Terror is about 20 million to 30 million people. Mm. And Conquest says, well, we might be able to, we should really be reasonable and raise it by 50%. Mm-hmm. So 20 to 30 20 and then to 30. And how does he know? What are the sources for this? He actually says in his book that the most reliable sources are political rumor in high places. That is, he says that this was being talked about by political leaders, no other source.
It sounds an awful lot to me like the 17 intelligence agencies all agree that Russia did this, that, or the other thing. So, all right, well, we've got like a minute left. And one of the things that I just want to point out, maybe we can
We use... only have a minute left?
Yes, we do. And so what I want to do...
I was stretching it.
No, that's okay. So what I want to do is get to... I guess we can start with that next week. You know, looking at one way that you measure, well, where your particular perspective is in relation to, say, objective reality, you know, when you're trying to move from the subjective to the objective, is to, you know, start taking, you know, account of context, of the facts that you do have. And so, for example, when you're looking at international relations and things that might motivate propaganda or a false narrative or fake news, you know, if you look at the objective conditions in which this is happening and then the interests of the parties involved, for example, in a situation where you have austerity being the only thing that can be delivered to, you know, the home audience, so to speak, a bunch of structures that have completely lost their legitimacy in the eyes of the population, no solution to that problem available, a fundamental need for a broader and deeper exploitation to sustain the model, and a rising multipolar world, you obviously have motivation to mischaracterize that particular multipolar world so that people see it as the threat rather than their salvation. I think maybe we'll start there next week because we're out of time.
Yeah.
Luciana, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.